is talk about how you connect quantum systems together. So if we, just as a jumping off point, think about the NV system, then what we saw with the NV system was that we had a spin one electron which is physically two electrons, but it behaves as one spin one space. And this is tensored to a nitrogen 14, which is also spin one. And we didn't talk much about it. And then there's potentially C13s somewhere in the diamond lattice. And each of these is a spin one half. And we had, for the electron, a Hamiltonian that was the exchange interaction. It comes in as sigma z squared, so the plus one and minus one levels are degenerate. There's a term that comes in as sz due to the Zeeman splitting. So if there's the magnetic field. And then with the with each of these, there's a hyperfine interaction as well. So, you know, if I think about the carbon is going to have some frequency, which is also a Zeeman frequency. But the magnetic moment of carbon is more than 1,000 times smaller than the magnetic moment of the electron. And so it's not negligible, it's important. But it doesn't give us quite the control we have here. And there's two terms from the hyperfine interaction. And the hyperfine interaction is just this magnetic-magnetic coupling between the nuclear spin and the electron spin. And there's two mechanisms for the hyperfine interaction. There's one that's through space, and there's one, so it falls off as 1 over r cubed, and would transform as a second Legendre polynomial in terms of its angular dependence. And there's a term that comes in as from the polarization of the electron orbital, the spin in the electron orbital, interacting with the nuclear spin. And that, of course, only happens if there's an overlap, so only if there's S character to the orbital. And so there's these two pieces, and we discuss that we keep the SZ terms because this is, for most experiments, by far the most important term, 3 gigahertz. This sets the energy scale. In other words, this tells us what good quantum numbers are. And this term is so small. You know, it's only some kilohertz, maybe a megahertz or so. And these terms are large. They're 30 megahertz to 100 megahertz, depending upon which carbon you look at. And of course, I've left off the nitrogen. So there's a term for the nitrogen, which comes in as a quadrupole splitting of the nitrogen plus there would be a Zeeman term of the nitrogen plus there's a hyperfine interaction. But because the nitrogen principal axis system is aligned with the principal axis system of the exchange interaction, there's no SX term. So because we chose the zero field splitting interaction, I go back and I draw this thing one last time. We say that we have a nitrogen and a vacancy. This is the principal axis system of the NV, meaning that it sets what we mean by the Z direction, or that the Hamiltonian of the exchange interaction is diagonal in that reference frame. And the principal axis system of the nitrogen quadrupole interaction is exactly along the same direction. So, whereas with the carbon spin, by modulating the states of the electron spin, I have universal control over the carbon spin because I have both sigma x and sigma x and sigma z. With the nitrogen spin, if I want to have universal control, then I have to directly drive the nitrogen spin. And this frequency is around 3 megahertz, and so it's a drag to drive. And so what usually happens is we forget that term. And when we do an experiment, the nitrogen will be in one of its eigenstates. It'll be in the zero eigenstate, the plus eigenstate, or the minus eigenstate. And it'll change the energy of the electron a little bit because of this term, okay? And that piece is about 1.2 megahertz. But otherwise, it's boring. Okay, so here we've got the nitrogen. We have an NV center. It has an electron. It has a useless nitrogen. And it probably has some C13s around that we can control. If we look out far enough, there's always going to be one. And the question is, how do we get to bigger Hilbert space? Because a 1 or 2 qubit quantum processor isn't that interesting. So we want to find a way of making these more complicated, more of increasing the size of the Hilbert space. And with the NVs, I forget. Was there a date scheduled to come by Rack 2?
This Thursday.
Perfect. Will one of you send me an email so it gets on my calendar? When you come over there, you'll get to see the NV setup. And the locations are random. And so then you say, OK, I've got two NV centers. How do I couple them? Or you could say, I have two quantum dots. Or I have two superconducting qubits. Or I have two ions. And the physics is all the same. And so what I want to do is to go over the physics of that in general. Now, We're going to do this for qubits. So forget about the NV for now, because it's a trick. And as I look at these qubits, we're going to say that the qubits are distinguishable. And so I'm going to give them different energies. OK, that's what we mean by distinguishable. So if I looked at the energy level diagram, then the energy level diagram, I guess I'll call it 0, 0. will look like that. And if I have a Hamiltonian that is like so, then the four allowed transitions all have unique frequent, all have unique energy splittings. So this transition, we're changing the second bit. So this is omega B, but it's conditioned on the first bit. So minus omega C over 2. And this one is conditioned on the first bit being set instead of being unset. And so we would have a term that was omega B plus omega C over 2. And here, omega A minus omega C over 2. And here, omega A plus omega C over 2. Okay, so we have four allowed transitions. They're dipole allowed. That means that we flip one spin. There's this transition here, which provided the difference in frequencies between A and B is large enough, is not allowed. That'll change, of course, as we go on. Okay. And so here we want to think about this, about control in this system where we have distinguishable qubits. Where the qubit energy depends upon the state of the other spin, of the other qubit. That's what this term says. It says that the energy of qubit 1 depends on the state of B. Yeah. Now we can there are three generic systems. We can go to a system where the energy separation is small. And then this piece becomes allowed. And so we have a Hamiltonian that's going to be very similar to this. Except here we have a scalar interaction between the two particles. And now this term I can rewrite and this piece I can rewrite. And so we get back to this idea of an exchange interaction. The labeling is all the same in these two cases. Okay? But you'll see in a moment that what we can do here and what we can do there are quite different. Okay? That the fact that this is isotropic gives us a different set of controls, where here we have an axially symmetric element of control. All right. And of course, I won't write it up. if the exchange interaction becomes the most, if mega C is the most important thing, then we get back to the NV case where we fall into the singlet and triplet manifolds. But then since we don't have two qubits, there's not much to talk about, so we won't talk about it. Good. I also want to I'm sure you've seen it or worked it out before, but to remind you that those terms commute. Good. Okay, so now let's look at control. And the first place to look at control is the simplest one, where we have the ZZ interaction between the two spins. And what we'd like to see in control is that we could take one spin and we could exchange it. We'll take one qubit and exchange it with the other qubit. That if I have the square root of the exchange interaction, then that's universal for control. So that's where we want to go. So basically, we're saying we've got a Hamiltonian with this term. And what I'd like to see is some process by which sigma xA goes to sigma xB and the identity is mapped to the identity. So this is what I'd like to see ideally. But let's start with the simplest case, looking at the evolution under this Hamiltonian. And of course, the we know immediately that Z commutes with it, so we won't bother to look at it. So we'll just take the initial state, sigma x, and ask, what does it evolve into under this bilinear operator? And of course, it evolves into sigma x. That's boring, but it evolves also into sigma y, sigma z. And now let me label those two just so that we keep the spins clear. And of course, if we look on the Bloch sphere, sigma x is clear, and of course, just the coherent superposition of the eigenstates, the z eigenstates. If I was to draw sigma x tensor the identity, then we want to remember that sigma x tensor identity is the same thing as sigma x where e plus and minus are idempotents. Of, in this case, the B spin. And so it says, oh yeah, sigma x tensor the identity says I have sigma x if the B spin is pointed up, and sigma x if the B spin qubit is pointing down. So here, I could draw two vectors. One for B in one, in the state one, and one for B in the state zero, and I should draw them as projectors. right? It's a mixed state. Over here, of course, we can look at it in exactly the same way. We can say that sigma ZB only difference is we pick up this negative sign for the two projectors. And so we evolve under sigma z into the state that if the spin is up, if the qubit's in the ground state, we're over here. And if the qubit is in its excited state, we're over here. And so what we mean by this state is that we have a correlation between the A and B spins. Okay? That if the B spin is pointed up, we're here. If it's pointed down, we're there. Okay. And of course, well, you know all this. But the full dynamic says that sigma xa goes to sigma xa cosine omega t plus I sigma y plus sigma y sigma z sine of the same term. All right. Now, this doesn't quite cut it, right? It says that instead of getting sigma x a to sigma x b, we got it to this correlated state. But if I allow the correlated state to evolve back in time, if I allowed it to continue to evolve in time, it would evolve back to sigma xa. It wouldn't evolve to sigma xb. So our process is going to look like this. So above the arrow is the Hamiltonian. That's the state. Below is the time. So we have the time that we're applying that Hamiltonian for is given by this coupling term. And then the state is going to evolve into and now I'm going to apply a rotation of pi over 2 for each of the spins. So if I rotate the y spin by x, it'll rotate into z. If I rotate the b spin by x, it'll rotate into minus sigma y. And if we allow this term to occur again, then this will evolve into sigma xb. So now, under this process that involves three steps, we get one piece of the evolution that we would want. But it's an easy thing to see that we will not get these two. I take sigma z, for instance, as the initial state. Sigma z is going to be a constant of the motion under the Hamiltonian sigma z. So then it's going to see only the pi over 2 pulse. It'll get rotated into minus y. And then the third evolution would take sigma minus sigma y into sigma x sigma z. And so this we get And these two we don't get. The identity we get. Good. Or bad. But now I want to fix that. So let's fix that. So we're still after a coupling. We want a coupling that's going to allow us to have a swap operation. We can see that using sigma z, we could build up something. And eventually, I should have said this at the beginning, we saw that we have the operators we have the set of five operators, sigma x on either the A spin or the B spin, sigma z on the A spin or the B spin, and this coupling term. And it's very easy for you to show that this leads to universal control, that by looking at the commutators of all of these terms, I can create any operator in that space. Okay, so we have universal control. And I can build sequences similar to this that do that operation, but I want to do that operation more compactly. So I'm going to go and look at this isotropic case. Just to write it down again, we have those three terms that commute. So if I want to look at the evolution of the system, then normally I would say, well, okay, this is a Hamiltonian, and I'm going to look at the Hamiltonian. Let's just put an angle there, like so. But since they commute, I'm allowed to rewrite that Hamiltonian. If I do it correctly, I'm allowed to rewrite the Hamiltonian. As though it was three actions instead of one composite action. And of course, the ordering of these don't matter, again, because they commute. Otherwise, you get into a lot of trouble. So this is good. So if I want to look at, and I'm going to look at sigma z. So if I want to look at the evolution of sigma z times the identity under this piece, sigma dot sigma, well, I'll take this one first, because it commutes with the input state, and therefore I don't have to do any calculation, and my life is easy. And so first we'll say that we have sigma z, which gives us, and then we'll look at the evolution under sigma x, and I should have said, of course, that anytime I'm looking at these evolutions, I want to know what the system evolves into. I'm just looking at the commutator, right? It always gives us what the system evolves into. And so here we end up with sigma y, sigma x. And now I evolve this under sigma y, sigma y. And this evolves into identity sigma z b. So now then, I have exactly the evolution that I want in the system. And notice that, of course, since this is isotropic, I don't need to do the calculation separately for x or y. They'll follow exactly this piece. So if we want to have control over our system, then a Hamiltonian of the form the dot product of the two polys allows us to generate any swap operation and therefore the square root of swap. And life is good. Now, here we have this, but there's two challenges. And they're going to give us two new tools. The first piece is that in the Hamiltonians we wrote above, there were the Zeeman interactions as well. And so we didn't have a Hamiltonian, in fact, which was just this term. We had a Hamiltonian that was this term plus the two Zeeman interactions. And that's going to screw things up, because if I take that Hamiltonian and I rewrite the full Hamiltonian, then I'm going to write it in a term way that I like. Yeah.
Can't you only separate the exponentials there if the operators that you're summing in the argument commute? Which they don't. So
where
see that h equals e to the i's sigma dot sigma, like on the top. Yeah, there.
Yes.
I think the next part.
Yes.
I think you can only do that, right? If they
commute.
The, yeah.
They do commute.
Sigma x and sigma y.
The product, top word. So sigma x times sigma x.
Okay.
Yeah. So you're exactly right.
There's a negative on each.
That's right. So you know of course sigma x and sigma y don't commute, but the bilinear operator does. Because you have two, and so you get rid of that negative sign.
All right.
Good. Okay, so if I look at this piece, then this is a troubling term because it doesn't commute with that. Okay, for arguments just like you said. And so now then, this one doesn't matter. Because I could always go to an interaction frame where that's zero. And going to an interaction frame where this is zero isn't going to change this one bit. But this term is a drag. And so we need to remove this term from the Hamiltonian. And remember that we're trying to build a processor. So I'm not going to remove the term by how I physically build it. I'm going to remove it by how I control it. And to cause this to go to zero is a lovely simple thing. So if I look at the evolution of the system, and for my convenience, I'm going to put a second pi pulse there. So this says I'm going to rotate the spins by 180 degrees about an axis of x. I'm going to rotate both a and b. And so if I had a term that went as sigma z a, then it would be positive in this case, and then I've inverted the system, so it'll be negative in this time. And of course, it would return to positive here. And sigma ZB would be the same, but sigma z a, sigma z b, I'd pick up a negative sign from each, and so it would be positive. And of course, it's also true of x and y. So by applying these two pi pulses, keeping these two times fixed, then on average over this process, the average of sigma z a, the average of the operator sigma z b, these both go to zero. But the average of the bilinear system stays. And so by applying a sequence of pulses, we can control, we can choose what we want the system to evolve as an average over, and we can tailor that as we like it to be. Good. I'm going to come back to that. And before I continue on with that, let's just look at this. So we take a Hamiltonian, which is a function of time. And then we would calculate a unitary, I'm going to make it a unitary of tau. So if the Hamiltonian is a function of time, then of course we can integrate over that time. As we integrate over the time, we need to be careful of the ordering, because this will not commute with itself at all times. So we introduce the Dyson time ordering operator. And we just integrate the system. Now, having defined, and this might be messy to calculate, but let's not worry about it being messy to calculate. You know, Dyson promises us you can calculate it, and that's all I care about right now. And then I can say, well, this piece is just an operator, and it's defined for that particular time tau. Right? It's only defined for that one process, just like we had over here. But for that one process, then I can associate with it a time-independent Hamiltonian. And that time-independent Hamiltonian would be an equivalent Hamiltonian that would provide the same action as this unitary, but if it was applied continuously. Okay, so it's not what we have. We have, well, in this case, we have this piecewise constant Hamiltonian that we're applying. But that's okay. This is formally a nice simple structure. It may not be that our experiment, although it's universal, gives us access to any operator on the space. It doesn't necessarily give us access to any instantaneous Hamiltonian over the space. So if I take an n-qubit quantum processor, an n-qubit quantum processor is still built up of two qubit Hamiltonians. right? Everything's bilinear. But I could imagine an operation which was an n-qubit coupling that would allow me to have a Hamiltonian involving a product of all n-qubits acting together. That one we could never create physically at an instant in the lab. But on average over time, we can create it. And so the average Hamiltonian gives us the effective action of some process at an instant or over an interval. Now, just to be clear, if I was to describe the average Hamiltonian, then I would need to describe it as a power series, effectively, of actions. And this first term would look just like the average. The second term would be the first order contribution of the non-commutivity. And each of the higher order terms would involve higher order commutators over this. But we could define it all. And the point that's important is actually this one, that over any process, we can create an effective Hamiltonian. And that if we have universal control, then we can generate any Hamiltonian over that space, on average over some process that takes an interval of time. Okay. So now I want to use that. So if I come back to this system, and we see that sigma dot sigma is a system that we want to have. But our coupling is almost always of this term. If I take two superconducting qubits, as we'll see in a couple of lectures, or even tomorrow, when I bring them together, then the field of one is going to bias the field of the other. And so we'll get a term that looks like this. And so in order to convert this into an effective Hamiltonian, to an average Hamiltonian, of the type sigma dot sigma, then all I need to do is to rotate both spins through sigma x, sigma y, and sigma z. So the term sigma z, sigma z, during this interval, transforms as sigma z, during this interval, as sigma y, and during this interval, as sigma x, sigma x. And then on average, over that process, we create the term that we want. Okay. I want to go back to looking at the four-level system we have above and to motivate what you're going to look at in the tutorial today. So take a two-spin system or two charged particles or two quantum dots, whatever you like. The most general noise in the system will couple in via the total magnetic moment. So imagine that you have your two electrons in a quantum dot, say. Then their interaction with the material that is composing that quantum dot will depend upon their total magnetic moment. And of course, these two states, which have total magnetic moments of plus and minus one, will be strongly influenced by the noise. Where these two states, where the total magnetic moment is zero, will not be influenced by the noise to first order. And so we would like to use these two states for our computation. Now, of course, it comes with a penalty that I start off with four levels and two qubits, and out of those four levels and two qubits, we pluck out two levels and say our qubit's going to live in those two levels. So there's an inefficiency built in that we're willing to trade off so that we can have good noise control. The other piece that's more of an issue is that this is only weakly allowed. And so what we'd like to do is to be able to create operators rotations within that space so that I could create any arbitrary superposition over those two. But I would prefer to do it in a way that I don't connect to those two. And I don't want to use this weak allowed piece because then it would be very, very slow. No one wants a slow quantum processor. So how do I do something fast? These things are fast. While not populating that state. And the first piece of this was shown by Hahn, who demonstrated that if you drive these two states, these two transitions, with the same frequency, so I have two microwave fields I'm going to drive, right? Because these transitions have different energies, so I can drive them separately. If I drive these two at the same frequency, then I can create an interference effect that will allow me to effectively drive just those two levels. And Hahn used this to introduce something called electromagnetically induced transparency, that he could create an interference. If you're living in this manifold, you could create an interference from this state such that you would never have a photon absorbed here or here, that they would interfere with each other, but you'd still be able to rotate between those two states. Okay, and that's the first piece you'll see. The next piece is, in my opinion, much nicer. And, okay, EIT is used a lot in optics experiments because then I can have a material which will absorb photons, and then I can arrange the state so it's transparent, so it doesn't absorb photons. And I can use that as a control element. But for us, we're interested in this manifold. You can detune from that. So you're driving to the wrong state. And there's a virtual state that you set up. And as you detune, you populate this state less and less. But you still drive between these two. And so I can have a system where I have a third level that I'm going to use for my control sequence. But I'm actually never going to populate it. But it's only because that third level is there that it allows me to have a transition between those two. And there's a couple ways you can see this, and that's what you're going to see in your tutorial. One way is you can go and you can look at the commutators of the control Hamiltonians and look at what action you get under the microwave field being the same frequency over those two transitions. So in other words, you go into the interaction frame of the microwave field. And when you do that, you'll see that you introduce the leading order term is the sigma plus, sigma minus, plus sigma minus, sigma plus term. You introduce a term that couples those two states. Okay. Another way is to just integrate the whole bloody thing and see the dynamic. As you're looking, you know, just integrating the whole thing is great when you have Mathematica in front of you. Hard way to get insight, but it's a good way to get the right answer. When you're looking at that evolution, as you look at the amount that you populate the undesired state, if you move both of your control frequencies away from the resonant case, so you still share an interaction frame, but you share an interaction frame that's tilted out of the XY plane. And in that interaction frame, you still have the control, but you don't have any populations into those systems. And maybe I'm not making this clear. Let me try. I'll say you've got a system where you have your qubit being the lowest, so we have a lambda system. and let's just call it A, B, and C. And I have a qubit where I'm labeling it as A and C, and I have a qubit where I'm labeling it as B and C. And if I'm driving this on resonance, then I'm putting a radio frequency field here. And it has some frequency omega Rabi. If I'm driving this one on resonance, I have some frequency corresponding to that, which is also Rabi. Now, this energy separation here, omega BC, here, of course, the Hamiltonian for this looks like omega Rabi as the strength times cosine of omega BC times T, right? These frequencies show up in this piece, but the amplitude of them is what's going to be the same. So we drive these two, and of course, as we're driving these two, and we're starting down here, yeah, then you can see that we would go to C. And you can see Hahn's first experiment that said, oh, I could prevent us from absorbing a photon because this is a shared level, and I could arrange that there's an interference between those two. If we then take the later piece with the virtual state, then it says, don't drive on resonance. And remember that when you don't drive on resonance, then there's an off-resonance piece that appears here, delta omega, which comes from this term, right? That you're driving at a frequency which is not equal to the transition frequency. And now then, your effective field is tilted away from the xy plane. And remember, we talked about this when we were controlling one qubit, that if you went off resonance, you could never rotate from one pole to the other because you're off resonance, you're always rotating in a cone. And that's the same exclusion that we have here. And if I tilt this to 45 degrees, then I will never populate that state. But I can, of course, create a coherent superposition between these two. Okay, so think about it in terms of the physics. But then, after you've thought about it in terms of the physics, we have a Mathematica notebook that Rahul wrote up that shows all the dynamics. So you get everything there. But if you look at the Mathematica notebook first, then, you know, it's no fair. In physics, you have to struggle a little bit. So we let you struggle first, knowing that you'll get immediate gratification before the hour's up. Okay, thanks.